The following takes place between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m.
I'm your huckleberry.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Alan Butler, and I would like to welcome you, my co-host and Taylor Austin, to Butler on Business. Jason, how you doing today?
I'm doing just fine, Alan.
I am.
How's everything going with you?
I'm fine. You know, we got some bogus economic information out today that I thought would have moved the market higher. My guess would be the folks up there in the Big Apple are seeing through the smoke screen. First thing right off the bat, remember yesterday they were talking about the positive news they got out of housing, and then here comes a report that says housing starts fell 4.1% in December to 657,000 unit rate. That in and of itself is not accurate. That's one of those seasonally adjusted numbers. I think we're hitting around 250,000. What last year was the lowest in record? It was 250-something thousand.
Right. Yeah, we also saw new claims for unemployment benefits. They fell to 352,000 last week. That was from an upwardly revised 402,000 the week prior. That was a drop of 50,000. Now, economists had expected a drop of only about 14,000. Right now, claims are at their lowest level since the week ending April 19th of 2008.
Well, John Williams at Shadow Stats had pointed out that the couple weeks following that holiday, the New Year's, these numbers were going to be volatile, and he didn't expect to see them settle down until probably about February. So you don't know if that 402,000 last week was the bad number or the 352, this week's announcement. You don't know which one of those is the bad number. Chances are they're both bad numbers. And here, speaking of another bad number, inflation at the consumer level, now this is according to the government, was unchanged in December, excluding the food and energy components. So just ignore the fact that right now gasoline prices are higher than they've ever been in recorded history for the month of January. Just don't pay any attention to that one, and don't pay any attention to the fact that food prices are up about 14%. Higher than where they were last year. Just ignore that one and go with this no inflation number that came out of the government today. And one thing I do think we should point out is the indices, the NASDAQ, the Dow, those are the indices, ventured into relatively new high territory yesterday. Now, resistance levels have changed considerably. I know a lot of these folks are now calling 1350, probably is in our cards. You remember that old 1350? We were there prior to that S&P downgrade, Jason.
Yeah, we're back to July levels now on the S&P.
Well, support for the NASDAQ 100, those are the Qs, QQQ, sits at a pivot high. The pivot right now is 2412. We're sitting at 2777. Resistance is at 2438. Oh, no, that can't be right. That's for the NASDAQ, the Qs. Support on the S&P, they're now calling 1305, and resistance is at 1330. I'd like to see 1330. The Russell 2000 is above its 10-day moving average. Now, you can buy the Russell 2000 in an ETF that's Indian Whiskey Mike. That is sitting at 77.72 Indian Whiskey Mike. That is the Russell 2000 ETF. If you like the S&P 400 mid caps, that's what we call the MIDI, MDY, Mike Delta Yankee. Jason, the dollar is down yet again today. It's been a drubbing for the dollar this week. And what about our real money, gold and silver? How are they behaving today?
Gold's off slightly. It's down about $4.50 at the moment to $16.54. Silver's flat, $30.50. And the NYMEX crude futures right now are up 0.8%, 101.38.
Funny, demand for oil is down, yet oil prices are up. I would blame that on the inflation that the government reports today does not exist, Jason. That is, seems to be a rather dichotomy of statistics there, wouldn't you? So supply and demand down, prices up.
Yeah, and we have to remember that the oil market is definitely a global market. So there's a lot of factors at play here, from everything from the geopolitical risk going on right now in the Middle East to demand in other countries besides the United States to the dollar pumping we're doing here at home. There are a whole host of factors when we're looking at a global market like oil.
To answer a listener question yesterday, where's Jimbo? Jimbo's not going to be on this week. You won't hear from Jimbo again until Friday. Now, I spoke to Jimbo this morning, and he's out doing his real job. He's got to be watching some production parts run for one of his suppliers today. But we do have a pretty good show lined up. Ileana Johnson, she's going to be on with us today. What are we going to be talking about to Ileana about, Jason?
Well, Obama's come out with a plan now. He's going to try to merge six agencies. He's billing this as a way to streamline government, to cut costs, but Ileana's going to explain how this is just more political smoke and ears. We're not smoke and mirrors. We're not going to be really doing away with any functions of these six departments. The departments in question, we're talking about things like the Commerce Department, the Office of U.S. Trade Representatives, U.S. Trade and Development Agency. Some of these agencies, he simply wants to merge them into a single function and actually, I believe, expand some of the power.
At the bottom of this hour, we're going to be talking to Steve Jacob. Now, he is a trend tracker on state and national health care policy, and he's going to give us an update on what's going on there. And we've got Ivan Elin. What are we going to be talking to Ivan about?
Well, Ivan's a great guest. I'm very excited. He's a senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty over there at the Independent Institute. We often have the good folks at the Independent Institute on the program. He holds a PhD in national security policy from George Washington. He's been director of defense policy studies at Cato, spent over a decade and a half working for Congress on national security issues. We're going to be talking about foreign policy in Iraq and also foreign policy right now with the U.S., what's going on with Iran.
Did you watch a judge last night?
No.
Did you watch that Georgia-Tennessee game last night?
Nope. I've been preparing for Butler on Business, just doing a whole host of research. I don't get a lot of TV time.
Well, I was watching it as I was preparing for Friday's show, Jason, and congratulations to the Georgia Bulldogs. Pulled off a 5-point win in overtime last night up there in Athens. Normally, I go to that game, but my sidekick, my son, he's going to school at UT, so I lost my partner going up to Athens once a year for that basketball game, but I always have a good time going up there. It was a good game. Jason, then mainstream media is all a Twitter right now over that XL pipeline. And you know what? I have to give kudos to Joe Herring up there in Omaha, Nebraska. Now, despite all this talk you're hearing out of the media on this XL pipeline, we know, and you know since you listened to us, that it was Warren Buffett. This Keystone Pipeline nixing was a payoff to Warren Buffett. At least that's what Joe Herring argues. Because Warren Buffett bought that railroad, and with no pipeline, that oil has to travel across Warren's railroad. So it's just crash crony capitalism. That's all it is. The opposition, that environmental opposition to this XL pipeline, is being financed by Warren Buffett's business partner. So don't believe the narrative that you're hearing on that. Now, I have heard that the Canadians are rather upset about it, and they made noise yesterday. They'll just sell that oil to China.
And you can't blame them. You can't blame them here. It's so obvious right now that, I mean, Obama is a populist. He's a progressive. He's trying to fire up his liberal base. He's trying to cater to the folks that are going to give him votes coming up here. And this is a political game, unfortunately, at the expense of American jobs and American energy.
Yeah, have you seen he's running against the Congress now? That's his campaign strategy. Can't run on his accomplishments, so he's going to run against the Congress. First of all, I think Congress is pretty easy to run against. I'll give you an example. That showboat last night on the resolution to avoid Obama's debt limit hike. I mean, any Republican, the Democrats, I just got to throw them out. I mean, there are a few moderate Democrats out there. I can think of the fellow up there in North Carolina, Heath Shuler. He's kind of a moderate Democrat. I'm sure there's one or two others out there whose names escape me right now. But so let's get back to the Republican side of it. You know, they made all that noise about the debt ceiling and the pledge to America and rolling back spending to 2008 levels. And then they brokered in a deal where the debt limit now goes up automatically. So anybody, Tom Price, who voted for that deal back in August and then voted against this symbolic gesture last night is nothing but a hypocrite. Plain and simple. Just hypocrisy. They're playing you for a fool. So they had their little show vote yesterday, voted it down after, just 4 months ago, voting for a mechanism that allowed this to go through automatically. We don't need those kind of representatives in Congress.
I said it yesterday, Alan. If anybody in my district or any of my elected representatives voted in August to put this automatic increase in place, voted for the increase of the debt ceiling, and now yesterday voted against this debt hike, the debt limit hike, that would be, for me, an automatic disqualification of my vote next time.
Tom Price. Okay, you saw yesterday, Jason, they plain left the gate with a gun on board. Now, despite all that groping and radiation, sitting there groping 8-year-old girls and 80-year-old women, they still managed to let a plane leave with a gun on board. Now, that doesn't say a whole lot for the Republican Party's TSA, Jason. Doesn't say much for me, but speaking of the TSA, they now admit wrongdoing in the two cases involving those elderly women that we reported on last month. It's an about face. The feds have admitted wrongdoing in the case of those two elderly women who were groped, strip searched at Kennedy Airport as being the responsibility of overzealous screeners. They said, you know, initially that they were following procedures, and now they're saying that they weren't. But I didn't create the TSA. The Republican Party created the TSA.
Well, one of the biggest news stories coming out this morning is presidential hopeful Rick Perry has announced, or will be announcing at 11, that he is dropping his presidential bid. He's going to make the announcement at a press conference in Charleston, South Carolina, and reports are now indicating that he will endorse former House Speaker Newt Gingrich.
And for the second time in less than a year, Timothy Geithner is raiding the federal pension funds to pay for all that deficit spending that Obama is currently enjoying. That's right. Now, you know, down in Buenos Aires, Argentina, they just took everybody's private pension money, made them buy government bonds. And didn't they do that in Ireland, too? It's been a couple countries that have done that. And here's old tax cheater Tim Geithner dipping into that federal pension fund. Now, you know, if you and I were to do that, Jason, they'd throw us in jail, but it looks like it's all right for the government to take their federal pension money and divert it to pay bills because they're spending money they don't have. This is Alan Butler. Jason and I will be back on the other side of the break to talk to Ileana Johnson about Obama's 6-agency merger, all smoke and mirrors.
The first night's the toughest, no doubt about it. They march you in naked as the day you were born. And when they put you in that cell, and those bars slam home, that's when you know it's for real.
Welcome back to Butler on Business, butleronbusiness.com. You can also find us on Twitter at butleronbiz. Our next guest taught economics as a college professor for 30 years. She writes frequently for Canada Free Press. And Dr. Johnson recently published a book about her 20-year experience in communist Romania titled Echoes of Communism. Dr. Ileana Johnson, welcome back to the program.
Yes, good morning, Jason. Good morning, Alan.
Hey, how you doing? Is it cold up there?
Oh, really cold, 19 degrees.
It was 28 here this morning when
wow.
I was out feeding my fish.
That's cold for Atlanta.
Yes, it is. My fish didn't know it was cold, though, since they're in a heated pond and the little steam came off their head when I was giving them their food. My buddies in the koi business always say I need to take a picture of it, but steam coming off the head of a koi doesn't photograph well, Jason. So how you doing today?
Wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Obama is up to more smoke and mirrors. He seems to be the smoke and mirror president. But and I saw a stat on how much money you realize when he took office, the national debt was $10 trillion. And it's going to be 17 trillion before this next election.
That's correct. And sad.
So for the first, 43 presidents, Obama will have borrowed more money. And by the time we get him out of office, the number 44 will match the borrowing of the first 43 combined.
That's true. That's so true and so sad. I don't know how if we'll ever come out of this or how long it will take, how many generations to pay it back.
Well, despite all of this reckless spending, he now has this new plan out where he's going to proposedly save about $3 billion over 10 years. That's $300 million a year by consolidating some federal agencies. Is this really a cost-saving initiative, or is there something else here?
No, not really. It's a drop in the bucket. It's about $300 million a year, and given the billions that he has already spent, as Alan mentioned, it's almost laughable if it wasn't so serious. It's not really even about streamlining government because he's saving anywhere from 1,000 to 12,000 jobs cut through attrition over years, so that's not much saving there either. And it's not just a transparent attempt at getting reelected. There are more complicated relationships and interests and outcomes here at stake, as I've outlined them in my article.
Well, tell us a little bit about his plan. He essentially wants to take six departments and merge them into a single agency?
Correct. He wants to merge the department, the Commerce Department, the Export-Import Bank, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, the U.S. Trade and Development Agency, and, of course, the Small Business Administration.
Now, how is this tied back to his national export initiative? That was something that he talked about in last year's State of the Union address, and it seems like there's some overlap here.
Yes, at the State of the Union address in 2010, he had promised the president to double the U.S. exports over the next 5 years and support 2 million American jobs by creating an export promotion cabinet, that is, to oversee government programs and special financing for farmers seeking overseas market opportunities. And the other goal was for tougher enforcement of international trade laws. And I have not seen anything yet materialize. At this National Export Initiative, the Senate did not funded in the 2012 Commerce Appropriation. So by doing all this collapsing, I think, this is my personal opinion, he thinks Congress will fund his NEI if it appears that he's streamlining his outlandish spending. And I seriously doubted that will happen.
Yeah, also part of this, it's the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. That's been often presented as helping the U.S. businesses establish a presence overseas, but it seems that might tie into a topic that we've talked frequently about, the sustainability, the UN Agenda 21 theme.
That's correct. As I searched deeper and deeper in this Overseas Private Investment Corporation, I kept falling into more rabbit holes. And I said, well, I have to stop at some point, but here's some of the goals of this OPIC. They are environmentally and socially sustainable, and this is from their annual report of 2010. They are compatible with low and no carbon economic development. They respect human rights, including the rights of workers and affected communities, vis-a-vis Agenda 21, of course, the UN Agenda 21. Avoid or provide mitigation and compensation for any negative impact. Carbon tax comes to mind. Provide timely project information to affected people. And are undertaken in countries that are taking steps to adopt and implement laws that extend internationally recognized workers' rights. So it appears that they're more concerned with the implementation of UN Agenda 21, low and no carbon economic development. They want to eliminate fossil fuels, and they are interested in international worker rights, which is an agenda of the Communist Party, USA. So it's not so tame as it appears.
Ileana, one thing I had a wise fellow point out to me with Obama is watch what he does, not what he says. because he is very good at saying one thing and doing another.
Exactly. And if you look at the Small Business Administration, this is the one administration that actually creates 90% of the jobs in the country. And do we really want to give him the power to control the Small Business Administration, which he would because he wants to move Karen Mills, the administrator of SBA, to or elevate her to cabinet-level rank, which in essence would become his underling, and thus he would be in charge of SBA, in my opinion.
Well, just as a point of a clarification, the SBA is not responsible for creating 90% of the new jobs. It's the small businesses that do.
Well, of course, but I'm saying the small businesses that are members of the Small Business Administration. Right, you're correct.
Okay, well, I never got any help from the Small Business Administration.
Yeah, that's extremely difficult. As any bureaucracy, I agree. They are supposed to help you, but that's a different story.
Well, as I recall, way back in the day, way back, you know, what they would do is help you with loans, but I never had them help me with any loans.
Yeah.
I don't know what function they serve. I know what function they're supposed to serve, but I've been involved in quite a few small businesses, and I never got a bit of help from the SBA.
I've heard that echoed many times from other small businessmen.
Well, so I, and women. So,
and women.
Yeah, what I would like to see Obama do in this streamlining is get rid of a lot of these departments. I don't, many people argue that the Commerce Department, then now they do, the Census Bureau, obviously, we need some sort of census taken. That's required by the Constitution, and the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which used to be what the Bureau of Standards and Measures.
Right.
Yeah, those are legitimate functions, but a lot of this stuff like business development and all that, I just think we're better off without them. Now,
I agree. They have a $7.6 billion budget.
Now, does the Export-Import Bank do anything other than help a few cronies? I mean, I know Jeffrey Immelt, he's a big fan of it.
Not really. It just helps their friends, you know, who want to buy quote-unquote product, U.S. products. And I gave an example here about the recent 825 insourcing jobs that were created in North Carolina when the bank helped Siemens Corporation sell some equipment to Saudi Arabia. And I made the point, you know, Saudi Arabia is awash in petrodollars, and Siemens Corporation is quite wealthy and can, with high credit rating, so they can get borrow money from the private sector if they wish to do so. We don't really need the Export-Import Bank.
Do you think this Office of U.S. Trade Representatives, I mean, what function do they really serve?
It's just more window dressing, really. As I showed the one individual who runs it, Ron Kirk, he is really involved in three of these six organizations. He's a known voting member of the Export-Import Bank Board of Directors, and so he's the U.S. Trade Representative, and he's also involved in the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. So it looks like a crony-type situation.
So now you're suggesting then that the evidence clearly shows that Obama's got something else up his sleeve. Just articulate that one more time.
Well, I don't think it's about streamlining government because he's not eliminating that many jobs. It's just more or less taking control of more sectors of the bureaucracy. It's not about saving $300 million a year because that's a drop in the bucket compared to the trillions he's already spent. And it's not just about the transparent attempt at getting reelected. It is more complicated trying to get his National Export Initiative approved, and he's trying to get Congress to get the Export-Import Bank reauthorized. So it's much deeper than that. There are many outcomes at stake, some of which I have not even mentioned in my article. As I said, I kept falling into more rabbit holes as I was researching. So it's more ominous than what's on the surface.
We really appreciate this research that you do. You really come up with some rather uncanny observations.
Oh, thank you.
And we always look forward to talking to you, but we're out of time right now.
Well, thank you, Alan.
Well, we look forward to having you on again.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. This is Alan Butler. Jason and I will be back with Steve Jacob on the other side of this break. We've got essentially a flat market with an upside bias. The Dow is up 10 points. The S&P is up 2. We'll see you shortly.
Welcome back to Butler on Business. My name is Jason Riddle, live in the studio with Alan Butler. We're joined now on the phone by Steve Jacob. He's a trend tracker on state and national healthcare policy and an award-winning veteran healthcare journalist. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jason. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you on. We should also note that you have written a book recently. It's called Healthcare in 2020, Where Uncertain Reform, Bad Habits, Too Few Doctors, and Skyrocketing Costs Are Taking Us. I think that most people realize that probably over the next 10 years, we're going to see a ton of changes in the healthcare industry, both with Obamacare coming through as well as other healthcare reforms. What's healthcare going to be like in 2020?
You know, you're absolutely right, Jason. Health reform is going to change the landscape quite a bit. We're not sure exactly how what that's going to look like because it's got to go through a Supreme Court challenge and, of course, needs to survive the 2012 election. But, you know, I think there are larger problems that we're going to be facing in 2020, you know, with or without health reform. In other words, health reform, I think, is probably a bit overblown and maybe a little bit misbranded. Health reform didn't really reform the healthcare system, and it really just, it's really health insurance reform. It just allows, you know, seeks to provide, you know, affordable health insurance for people either through supplying it through Medicaid or through these health exchanges. But I think the bigger problem is the skyrocketing costs that I talk about in that title. If you look at, I calculated out, if you took the healthcare costs in Georgia, for example, and if you projected forward the costs increases or the cost trajectory of the last 5 years, you know, by 2020, the average family premium is going to be about $22,500, and that's compared to a little over $13,000 today. And then the average deductible will be almost $4,800 compared to about $2,000 today. So, you know, if you take all those together, if you take the premium and you take the deductible, you know, another the employee share of the premium and the deductible together, that'll comprise about 14% of Georgia's projected median household income. And you've got basically, you know, the rule of thumb is if it constitutes 10% of your household income, it's a burden. So it's really going to be a real albatross, I think, for many, well, certainly Georgia households, but households throughout the country. In fact, that 14% in Georgia is going to be a little bit better than the national average, which I calculate to be about 17%.
Steve, so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So the, to me, that is going to be the number one problem. Number two will be access. You know, well, there will be 32 million more people with health insurance. You know, we're giving all these people insurance either through Medicaid or and then requiring them to get it either on their own or through the health exchanges. And so you're going to have a lot of people seeking care, and we're not really growing the health care provider workforce quickly enough, particularly doctors. So to me, cost and access are going to be two very, very difficult problems with or without reform.
Steve, in a perfect world, how would you reform it?
Well, I, you know, there's no one magic bullet. basically, some of the things that are embedded in health reform could certainly sort of change the trajectory. Right now, the incentive is for doctors to offer or to supply as much care as possible, because every time they do something, they get paid for it. But some of the things that have been proposed is to give them one flat payment to take care of people or to take care of an episode of illness. In other words, let's say I got a heart attack, you know, now if I went into the system, you know, the hospital gets paid one fee, the doctor gets paid another, and the radiologist gets paid. So it, all of this sort of, it's like an assembly line, and everybody gets their payment. But they're trying to aggregate providers so that they get one payment, so that, for example, one entity would get paid $25,000 to take care of me and my heart attack, and if they do it for $15,000, they get to keep the balance. So the incentive would be to provide less care rather than more. And I think that would be a start. But there's many, many, many other things that we would need to go after. Right now, the FBI says anywhere between $3 and $10 out of every 100 are earned fraudulently in health care. And that's compared to like 7 cents out of every $100 for credit card fraud. So it's very pervasive that we need to go after that. There's many other reforms we should be pursuing, giving patients a greater say in their care. When you do that, you probably save 25 to 30% of healthcare costs, because patients generally, given the choice, pick more conservative treatment. And there's, you know, we don't have a lot of time to go now, but this book is kind of sprinkled with those kinds of solutions. So there's not one silver bullet, but there's a lot of things we can be doing.
Steve, how about just the personal health habits of Americans? Does government have any role to promote more healthy lifestyle choices? Are there things that we can be doing to encourage people just overall to be healthier? I think that seems like that would tie into lowering healthcare costs in general.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you want one solution, that's the solution. The biggest solution lies within all of us, because if you take the healthiest 50% of Americans, they spend 3% of the healthcare dollars. So if you're healthy, you only spend about $200 every year on healthcare, as opposed to if you were, among the sickest. I mean, you're spending boku dollars there. It's frankly the sickest people consume the most healthcare. But you know, if you look at how if you look at our personal health habits, if you take just these simple health habits, which is, you know, being of a normal weight, you don't smoke, you eat nutritionally, you drink moderately, and you're physically active. If you do all those things, you can you cut the risk of heart disease and cancer and diabetes by 80%. But only 3% of Americans do all those things, meaning, you know, the other 97% are falling short on one or more of those measures. So if you take care of yourself, you keep yourself out of harm's way, and you keep your money in your pocket. So really, the only true way to bring down healthcare costs is to use less healthcare.
Yeah, and the key here that we need to always remember is that the problem is healthcare cost. We talk, obviously, access is very important. A lot of the reform, as you mentioned earlier, is centered around health insurance. But if we keep having these skyrocketing healthcare costs, then the rest of the reform seem like they're going to do little to actually address the core issues here.
You're absolutely right. That's in fact the case. And, you know, a lot of, you know, these cost increases are blamed on Obamacare and all this sort of thing. But the thing is that this has been going on. Medical inflation's run 2% ahead of the consumer price index since 1960. So this has been around for nearly half a century, and it keeps compounding itself. So any these reforms are not going to work as long as these healthcare costs continue to rise as swiftly as they are. You know, they've moderated a little bit because of the recession, but that, you know, history shows that they pick back up when the economy gets better. And people are basically sort of delaying care, you know, if they don't have the money. About 4 out of 10 Americans have unmet healthcare needs because of costs.
The book is Healthcare in 2020, Where Uncertain Reform, Bad Habits, Too Few Doctors, and Skyrocketing Costs Are Taking Us. Steve Jacob, we appreciate your time. Tell our listeners where they can find a copy of your book.
It's on Amazon.com.
Steve, thank you very much. We look forward to having you on again.
Thank you so much.
This is Alan Butler. Jason and I will be back on the other side of the break. There's a little more steam behind the market right now. The Dow's up 25, S&P is up 4. We'll see you shortly.
It's a pretty unlikely possibility. We've never had a decline in house prices on a nationwide basis.
There's been nothing that was indicated this wrong, you know, with Fannie Mae.
I've represented affordable housing organizations to build affordable housing.
Mr. Chairman, we do not have a crisis at Freddie Mac, and in particular at Fannie Mae.
And I'm confident, in fact, that the bank regulators will pay close attention to the kinds of loans that are being made, making sure that underwriting is done right.
But you're not going to see the collapse that you see when people talk about a bubble.
Let's see if we can distribute risk more broadly and make it easier to provide loans to people who otherwise might not be able to get them.
But I do think that this is mostly a localized problem and not something that's going to affect the national economy.
I'd say they missed the vote on that one rather badly, Jason.
No question about it. No question about it.
Eric Fry with The Daily Reckoning. How adjusting for slippage adds to sovereign debt woes. Not like Eric's commentary. Last Friday, the French gained yet one more reason to grumble about we annoying Americans. S&P, as you know by now, that's the American ratings agency, the one that downgraded the U.S. back in August. The one that left the mortgage-backed securities all rated AAA as they fell to zero. But last Friday, they downgraded the French government's credit rating from AAA to AA+. That's the same rating we have now, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's long overdue, and it's still way too high, just like ours is.
Well, Angela Merkel, that's the German chancellor, said that AA+ is really not a bad rating, but the French were not so eager to agree with her assessment, and neither were any of the other 9 Eurozone governments that received a similar downgrade from S&P. Now, although Finland, the Netherlands, Luxembourg still hung on to their AAA ratings, S&P placed these three sovereign issuers on negative watch. They were the lucky ones. Austria lost its AAA rating, while Cyprus, Italy, Portugal, and Spain were all cut two notches. The latest downgrades put Portugal deep into the junk territory, and Italy is now rated as near junk. Now, S&P dispersed enough bad news to annoy almost everybody over there on the European continent. No surprise that one influential European finance minister said he plans to huddle with his fellow Eurozone members to create a European rating agency. They don't like these American rating agencies since they've been downgraded.
I think this is missing the point here a little bit. This is like, I don't know, getting mad at the judge or the teacher or whoever is scoring your performance, that if you did a really bad job, if you failed to show up and do what you're supposed to do and get bad marks for it, then you're going to go try to go create another judge or another teacher, another rating agency. It's not the rating agency that has the problem. It's these governments that spend too much and don't have enough income, enough resources to possibly honor their obligations.
Well, do you think that's worse, or the BAMster, President Obama, investigating S&P for their downgrade?
I think it's neither one of them surprised me, actually. I mean, it's an instance here where we have these organizations that are basically set up to help perpetuate the idea that these sovereign nations are 100%, you know, reliable, that they will never fail, and then now we've gotten to the point where it's overwhelmingly obvious that several of them are going to fail, that they are insolvent, in fact, and then when these rating agencies are pushed to the point that they have no other option to maintain any of their credibility that they have left, they have to come out and downgrade these countries now. They should have been downgraded months, if not years ago, but now they are finally having to just maintain some credibility, come out with these downgrades, and then the governments get upset and do what you said, investigate the rating agencies. It's a bunch of politics, again, going on here. It has nothing to do with actual market realities of what these bonds are worth.
I think that's well put, Jason. Now, using Eric Fry's analogy, he says the facts are what the facts are, and the facts are that many pupils in this class are receiving failing grades. Eliminating Fs from the grading scale won't improve their command of the subject matter. Many pupils would still be insolvent and moving toward a default. Now, it was just a few days ago, for example, Spain disclosed that its budget deficit would be just a wee bit larger than expected, 8% of their gross output rather than the 6% they had previously stated. That's a 33% miss right there, Jason. That's probably pretty good for government work. Now, apologizing on Spain's behalf, European Commission Vice President Olli Rehn said he regrets the sizable fiscal slippage. Yeah, I'd kind of regret that too, but this comment bore an eerie resemblance to the comment that the Greek finance minister uttered just 3 months ago to describe his nation's downwardly revised budget deficit forecast. He said, "We are adjusting for slippage." That's a pretty fancy term nowadays, slippage. I guess we're slipping, Jason. The deficit that was supposed to total a hefty 7.6% of their output slipped to an even heftier 8.5%. So adjusting for slippage is the government's latest fashion, and it is expensive. Governments of the world's leading economies have more than $7.6 trillion of debt maturing this year, as reported by Bloomberg News, with most facing a rise in borrowing costs. You know, I guess slippage over here, what we're calling a primary budget, I think that's always worth pointing out now. When they're giving you these, even their phony budget numbers, it's their primary budget. You remember, we didn't even have the term primary budget a year and a half ago, but the primary budget is now our budget deficit without interest being calculated. It's kind of like you counting your household family finances and leaving your mortgage out. That's what our government is doing for us.
Well, yeah, and that's to account for this rising borrowing cost. Right now, Japan and the United States, they account for by far the lion's share of that $7.6 trillion in refinancing that you said that's coming due this year in Europe. Italy has by far the most amount of debt coming due this year. And, you know, you have to look at the facts here. The Italians have to find a way to get together about $500 billion just in 2012 to satisfy the bonds that are maturing this year. After Italy, France comes in second. They have the most amount of debt coming due in Europe behind Italy. They got about $367 billion coming due this year, and Germany has about $285 billion coming due this year. So governments around the world are going to have to raise some money, and all of this in the face of increased borrowing costs.
Well, that's a whole lot of borrowing. But again, even these numbers don't tell the entire story, but we'll tell you the entire story on the other side of the break. My name is Alan Butler. On behalf of my co-host and our lovely producer, we'll see you back in a couple minutes.
The following takes place between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m.
I'm your huckleberry.
Won't you take me back to school? I need to learn the code.
Welcome back. We've got a market, I don't know if you could call 26 points on the Dow rally, Jason, but what I find interesting, you know, the big sector of the day is the financial sector. I still think those insiders up there are hotly anticipating QE3, which brings me to a subject. The original bankers that drafted up the Federal Reserve System, they wanted a way to devise a method that allowed them to pass on losses in the banking system to we taxpayers, and I would say by extension to anybody using U.S. dollars, without us knowing about it. I mean, these guys were talking about bailouts long before this current round of bailouts began. In the meeting, they had lengthy discussions about the prospects of not letting a bank or firm fail. And they always say, well, you know, it could lead to a financial crisis. Now, we're talking about this meeting, the one they had here in Georgia on Jekyll Island back in 1910. So part of that meeting was to devise a plan to let them keep their profits, but push their losses off onto us. And it has worked beautifully for them.
Well, Alan, this also ties nicely into the discussion we were having before the break about the $7.6 trillion in government debt coming due this year. The sovereign nations are going to have to raise that amount of money to stay sovereign. And the banking system that they set up is a very convenient way to also not only help the bankers avoid losses, but help the government perpetuate this out-of-control spending, run these constant deficits, these outrageous debts, and, again, put it on the expense of everybody else.
Well, these bailouts that we have mentioned have been going on and on and on. You can just go back to, it's not just the $7 trillion in backdoor bailouts that the Fed provided, but, I mean, it's been a long history. Penn Central Railroad, 1970, Lockheed, New York City, Chrysler, Cotton, Illinois, and the IMF gets the money from the Fed. The Fed gets the money from the people of the U.S. You just don't realize it because they're getting it from you by way of inflation. The Fed has been wrong, Jason, about everything in the last decade. So why do we keep giving them more power? We played a clip in the last segment just showing you how clueless Ben Bernanke was when it came to the housing bubble, but that's just an example.
Well, it's almost a mystical phenomenon. We look at these wizards up on Wall Street, these folks that are up, you know, on high, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke. These folks, they must be pretty smart, right, to get these positions. Of course, they should be able to manage the economy with this very, very technically sound system that we have in place. Of course, history shows that it's failed, that it fails over and over, that it constantly has devalued our dollar since they were started nearly 100 years ago. They've created more frequent and more severe economic recessions and depressions. Yet, folks, still, it's almost the emperor's new clothes. People don't want to realize the gravity of trusting an individual. Whether or not you think that Ben Bernanke's doing a good job or a bad job, the fact is that the position that he's in is an impossible job. It can't be done well. And folks, even Alan Greenspan, he set up the dot-com bubble. He fueled the housing bubble. Chairman Bernanke has come in and made similar mistakes. So it's not necessarily the fact that the particular person in charge right now is even worse or better than past Federal Reserve chairmen. The fact is it's an impossible position for any human being, but we trust in this position because it's almost a position that we can't conceive of how anybody can do it, so the person that has it in charge must be really smart, but unfortunately, they're oftentimes very wrong.
Like old Bernanke was in 2005. I mean, during the height of the housing bubble, we've played this clip before, when he was asked if he felt we were seeing a bubble in real estate, and if this bubble were going to burst, his reply was, "It's a pretty unlikely possibility. We've never had a decline in house prices on a nationwide basis. So what I think is more likely is that house prices will slow, maybe stabilize, but I don't think it's going to drive the economy too far from its full employment path." Then in March of 07, I mean, you can remember when we first began to see chinks in the subprime market, his comment was, quote, "The impact on the broader economy and financial markets of the problems in the subprime markets seems likely to be contained. I'd say you missed that one, Jason.
Well, in June of 2008, going right up to the footsteps, right up to the door of the financial crisis, just a few months before the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008 was signed into law by Bush. That was October 6th. On June 9th, we saw Bernanke say, despite a recent spike in the nation's unemployment rate, the danger that the economy has fallen into a substantial downturn appears to have waned.
So, after the Federal Reserve and our wise leaders in Washington, I would argue, caused a financial crisis they couldn't even see coming, we decided to give them more power and more ways to expropriate our wealth. Now, tucked into the 451-page bill that created TARP is a provision that lets the Fed pay interest to its member banks on the reserves banks are required to hold by the Fed. So now you got a situation where the Fed was requiring them to hold this money, and the Fed is paying them interest to hold newly created money.
Well, it's something we talk about often on the phone, Alan, except for coins, every dollar in circulation, all the Federal Reserve notes that we have in circulation now created privately are created as debt to the Federal Reserve or to the banking system that it heads up. If the Fed's money comes ultimately from the taxpayers, that means that we, the taxpayers, are paying interest indirectly to the banks on the bank's own reserves that they are required to hold.
Pretty good system, Jason. That's a good business model. Let's go back to talking about this fiscal slippage, the new term, the new euphemism for badly blowing one's budget. It's not automatically expensive, as the falling interest rates on U.S. Treasury securities can attest, but it is very expensive for those countries that have lost the faith of investors. Now, right now, we're still blessed here in the United States. We have the world's reserve currency. But even that's beginning to slip. And eventually, all eyes will turn away from Europe and on to the United States, and we will see a return of higher, if not much higher, interest rates. Now, Europe's sovereign borrowers are finding themselves into two camps, Jason. Either they're the haves or the have-nots. Now, because Italy and Portugal, for example, are have-nots, the confidence of bond investors, these two governments are paying a much higher interest rate. Now, the haves, Germany, pretty much the standalone have over there now, they have a much lower interest rate. I have a bond buddy of mine who did point out that the U.S. would not default on its treasuries because we can always print up new dollars. But that is in itself a form of default.
Yeah, instead of calling these folks the haves and the have-nots, I think it maybe is more appropriate to term them the makers and the takers. We have folks like Germany, their economy is making, they're producing wealth. And then you have other economies, by and large, through the ill deeds of their governments, the Greeces of the world, the Italy's, Spain's, that tend to be more takers, the welfare states. Where the welfare state is the strongest, you have a higher degree where the government is the taker, and that drains from the folks that actually make and produce. So I would classify them as the makers versus the takers rather than the haves versus the have-nots.
I think that's well put. Now, as the last remaining stable AAA sovereign borrower in the Eurozone, German government bonds are attracting that flight to safety, the same one we see here, and it's a trend that has been underway for many months. But while Germany's interest costs are plummeting, many European countries are struggling with rapidly rising interest costs, and for a good reason. You take Italy, for example. Italian interest rates are rising because Italy is strapped for cash, but so are most of the other Western nations, including the United States. Keep in mind, we have to raise the debt ceiling this week. Oh, Timothy Geithner's robbing the federal pension money again for the second time this in a year. We're out of money. In fact, the U.S. just made the wrong sort of headlines by announcing its debt to GDP just topped a Greek-like 100%. We're on our way to $17 trillion in official debt. The real debt's a lot higher than that, but they're not going to count it, so we won't bring it up right now. But it is not the kind of headline you want to print in big block letters, Jason.
No, it's not. And going back to my theme, one of the reasons right now that our country is in a lot of trouble is because we have shifted. Historically, America was known as the land of the free. We were known as the nation of makers. And now, unfortunately, through the ever-increasing welfare state, through an overall shift in mentality of our society, we have become a nation of takers, whether it's from bailouts, whether it's from trying to get a special hand up in government for corporate subsidies, whether it's sitting on the couch and collecting unemployment checks from the government and not trying to make something of yourself. Unfortunately, we've shifted from a society of makers to a society of takers, and that, I think, is the core problem here.
If you happen to see that interview with that college professor down in Florida where about 90% of his students in a classroom assignment were pointing out all the things that the federal government should be giving to them, guaranteeing them a job, paying for their education, giving them the down payment for their mortgage, ignoring, forgiving the mortgage if they couldn't pay the bill. It is...
Well, that's a red flag that we are in trouble, but unfortunately we're out of time for this segment. When we come back after the break, we're going to be speaking with Ivan Elin. He's the senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. We're going to be speaking with him about foreign policy in Iraq and Iran and how to avoid a return to even greater conflicts in the Middle East. Welcome back to Butler on Business. My name is Jason Riddle. Over to my left is Alan Butler. We're joined now on the phone by Dr. Ivan Elin. He is a senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. He holds a PhD in national security policy from George Washington University, and he wrote the book Partitioning for Peace and Exit Strategy for Iraq. And today we're going to be talking about foreign policy in Iraq and Iran. Dr. Elin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
To start off, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about the way Iraq is structured with the Sunnis, the Kurds, and the Shiites, and how that interaction works over in the nation of Iraq?
Iraq is an artificial country which was created by the British after World War One to push the oil provinces together because they wanted control over the oil. And so they were all these provinces were in the Ottoman Empire when the Turks ran it up until the end of World War One, but they didn't really interact with each other. They interacted with the Central Turkish Empire. So they don't really have much connection with each other, the regions of Iraq. You have the Sunnis who have always run things in Iraq traditionally up until Saddam Hussein was overthrown, and they're a minority, but the most powerful minority. All the kings of Iraq had been Sunnis. The Shia, who are 60% of the population, the majority, they have always been the ones ruled. Now, of course, the government is reversed. The Shia are in control of the government, and the Sunnis are being persecuted by the Shia, sort of payback for Saddam and all the previous Sunni rulers oppressing the Shia. And the Kurds, there are people without a state. They're in four different countries, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And there's a big group of them in Iraq, and they've really created their own state since 1991, the first Persian Gulf War, when the U.S. Protected them. And they've been able to nurture at least some sort of democracy there, and they're a lot more stable than the other regions of Iraq. So you have these three groups. But they all have conflicts, and they all want to control the Iraqi central government, or at least they don't want the central government to be controlled by another group and oppress them. And the Kurds really don't want to be in Iraq at all, and it's somewhat doubtful that the other two groups want to coexist together. So we have this situation, this artificial situation, and of course Iraq has been ruled by iron fist of either kings or dictators up until Saddam was overthrown, and therefore you have a situation, and the big question is, can Iraq survive as a unified country without a tyrant running the place with an iron fist and oppressing the, you know, and he's part of one group, and he oppresses the other groups with armed force. And now we're sort of going back to that because Nouri al-Maliki, who's the Shia leader of Iraq, he's growing more authoritarian and trying to close the Sunnis out of the government. And I think that's going to lead to a problem. That's why in my book I advocate decentralizing Iraq. And I did so while the U.S. was there. And I still advocate that because I think it's really the only way that the three groups can live together, if each one provides their own security and justice organizations. They can have a free trade area, that sort of thing. And you know, you could have an economics ministry to administer the free trade area. But I think security and the justice functions really need to be in a local level because nobody has confidence that the security and the courts are not going to be used against them by another group.
You touch on a number of subjects. First, I understand that when the British divided up Iraq, created Kuwait, they were rather recklessly splitting boundaries, dividing up, for example, the Kurds and things like that. Now, I have friends that are Middle Easterners so that said that was intentional because they wanted to have them in almost a state of war with each other so that the Brits could sell them their weapons. I don't know if that's true or not, but it did bring to mind when Saddam claimed that Kuwait was historically the 13th province of Iraq, wasn't he actually speaking the truth?
Well, to some extent, I mean, the people in Kuwait don't really want to be part of Iraq, so I think you have to sort of go with what the people in any particular area want. And I think that's what we need to do in Iraq as well, because certainly the Kurds would like their own independent country, but they're scared of Turkey getting really riled up because there are Kurdish people in Turkey who would like to abandon Turkey, and the Turks are afraid that any independent Iraqi Kurdistan would draw some sort of union with their own Kurds. And you have other interested parties. Iran is, of course, supporting the Shia because it's a Shiite country, and other Sunni countries like Saudi Arabia and Syria and Jordan have been supporting the Sunnis in Iraq because they're Sunni countries, or at least they're you know, prone to support the Sunnis.
Was the elimination of Saddam Hussein, could that be viewed as somewhat of a destabilizing influence on the Middle East?
Well, you know, the Bush administration, when they did it, they spoke about you know, bringing democracy and that sort of thing. But the problem with Iraq is you might eventually be able to have democracy, but I think some parts of Iraq are ready for it more than others. The Kurds are certainly more ready than the Sunnis and the Shia are. But it's if they had some sort of a loose confederation, every area, and it doesn't have to be three areas, it could be more than three, they could have their own government, and the different regions of Iraq could evolve the way they evolve. And so I think we don't know whether it's going to be more stable. Now, it certainly was more stable under Saddam. Whether there's less people killed, I think, is in doubt, because a lot of people were killed in the U.S. Invasion and also in the ensuing guerrilla war. So, and of course, Saddam was killing people too. But we don't know what the end game here. If there's a massive civil war, then you know, Saddam may end up looking good, and that's pretty hard to do since he was a really brutal dictator. But we don't. The problem when we help out and interfere in other countries such as Libya, which we just did, removing Muammar Gaddafi, or in the case of Iraq, removing Saddam Hussein, is we just don't know what comes next. And these guys were secular dictators. They were brutal dictators. There's no doubt about that. They were not nice people. But if you get some sort of Islamist government, that's always been the danger, that the Muslim world has gotten much more conservative, and a lot of these Islamist parties have gotten support, public support in these countries simply because they were the only opposition in the mosques to these brutal dictators, the only opposition that was tolerated at all. And so Islam has become a political force beyond compare in these countries. And so we don't really know where that ends up. Are they hostile to the U.S., more hostile than they would have been? Because if you recall, we had helped Saddam Hussein in his war with Iran, and also Muammar Gaddafi had given up his nuclear program and started playing ball with the West before we ousted him. So I'm not sure that's really both of these countries, both Saddam and Muammar Gaddafi, had given up their nuclear weapons, and I'm not sure that's a good thing to message to send to Iran, that if you give up your nuclear weapons, you get overthrown, and because that will motivate the Iranians to get a nuclear weapon faster than they would normally. Now, of course, Gaddafi didn't have nuclear weapons, but he had a nuclear program, and neither did Saddam, but he had a nuclear program, and both of them got rid of their nuclear programs, and look where they ended up in the ash heap of history. So that's not a good message to send to the Iranians.
Why do you think the Kurds have been relatively so successful over there?
Well, I think they've had an enclave where Saddam couldn't get to them because of the U.S. no-fly zone, and they have more democratic tendencies. I think they have two parties. It's not a strict democracy because they sort of alternate in power every 2 years, but they do have more than one party, and there's a third opposition group that's also there as well. So, and they do have, they are thriving compared to other parts of Iraq because they have a freer economy and that sort of thing. And I think they have more freedom. And, you know, there may be cultural factors as well. So I think certainly they do not want to be ruled by Baghdad because there's not a, and also they have oil up there, and they're cutting their own deals with oil companies, much to the consternation of the central authorities in Baghdad. And then there's also a dispute between the Kurds and the Sunnis over Kirkuk, which is a city near the border of the Kurdistan part of Iraq and the Sunni part of Iraq. And it has a lot of oil in that area, and so that's a possible flashpoint. There are many flashpoints in post-U.S. Iraq, and I'm afraid we haven't seen the end of the violence yet.
Now, ancient Kurdistan, it takes up parts of Turkey, parts of Iraq. I believe they bleed over into Iran and then Syria. Would that be the fourth
right,
country?
Right, those are the four countries, right.
And when they created, or when the British started drawing their little lines on a map, I mean, they basically split up what was, prior to that, known as Kurdistan. Is my history correct?
Yes. And so the Kurds really don't have a country. They're spread out all over the place. And so the Iraqi Kurds would like to form their own country. But, of course, Turkey, prevents them from doing that right now, I think, is, well, the United States was in Iraq, and of course they were under U.S. protection. But now the thing that's preventing them will be Turkey, because Turkey is very powerful, and they really don't want some of the Turkish Kurds who are a rebellious group operate from Iraq, shelters in Iraq, and so Turkey is not at all enthusiastic about any sort of independent Kurdistan. But certainly the Kurds are thriving as they currently are, so they may have some incentive to stay in Iraq if they're left alone. But I think Nouri al-Maliki is trying to assert more authority over all groups in Iraq, and I think he's moving down the road toward dictatorship after the U.S. leaves. So we'll have to see where that ends up. But I don't think the Kurds will stand for that, and I think they're nervous, just like the Sunnis are, that the Shia are going to use the government to oppress them. And the reason they fear that is because that's been the history of Iraq, is the Sunni, in this case, the Sunnis oppressed everybody. Now it may be the Shia that are oppressing everybody since they have control of the central government. That's why I think we probably need to, I think that the Iraqi groups should probably try to weaken the central government. And although the ideal time to do that would have been when the U.S. was there and could shepherd the process, but now, of course, we have a vested interest controlling the government, so now it's going to be much harder to decentralize Iraq.
Dr. Elin, we only have about 30 seconds left, but what should the U.S. be mindful of in order to avoid a return to Iraq?
Well, I don't think we can get enmeshed in the internal things, and I don't think we can be enamored with oil. I have a new book out called that's just hot off the presses. It says it's called No War for Oil, U.S. Dependence in the Middle East. And I think this whole area, we overstate the importance of oil. Oil is a valuable commodity, as you guys know, and people like to trade in it. And we don't need a lot of military power ensuring supplies, even if we have to pay a little bit more for it. It's cheaper than keeping all these military forces and getting dragged into these civil wars and that sort of thing. So I think the main thing is we shouldn't worry as much about the oil, and if we don't have to worry as much about the oil, then we don't have to worry about as much about what happens in Iraq. We've given them their chance at democracy, and they need to step up and peacefully get along with each other. If they can't, then I guess they're going to have a war to sort it out. But at any rate, the United States shouldn't be as involved in that. And I don't even think the United States should be as involved in trying to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, simply because Iran is probably going to get a nuclear weapon, and there's nothing much we can do about it unless we want to do a ground invasion of Iran, and that makes the invasion and war in Iraq look like a picnic. So I think we're going to have to get along with a nuclear Iran, just like we got along with a nuclear radical China under Mao during the 1960s.
We've got two great books to add to your reading list, Partitioning for Peace and No War for Oil. Dr. Ivan Elin, it's been a pleasure. He's a senior fellow at the Independent Institute. We enjoyed speaking with you today and look forward to having you on the program again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Alan Butler on the other side of the break. We'll be talking to our political guy, Chris Merola. We look forward to seeing you in a couple minutes. Welcome back, Chris Merola. Jason, tell them about Chris.
Chris is the president of Red Momentum Strategies. Good to have you on again, Chris. We don't have your picture here, so we're looking at a picture of Calvin.
Calvin's great. He's my buddy, named after Calvin Coolidge, the greatest unsung hero of all presidents, so that's fine.
And we paid short shrift to some unsung heroes yesterday when we were saying five. I've counted eight good guys in the Senate. My favorite is Jim DeMint.
Might as well. I like Coburn also.
All right. Well, I got him on my list here. In no particular order, Jim DeMint, Jeff Sessions, Mike Lee, Rand Paul, John Thune, Marco Rubio, Tom Corbin, Coburn, and Ron Johnson.
I would agree.
All right. Did I leave anybody out, or we got to keep digging?
Well, what about John Tile?
Yeah, I don't know now. He's kind of Arizona John Kyle?
Correct.
I think he's been on both sides of the fence here a couple times.
Okay. I just want to throw that out.
All right. I generally like him. I know now, and he's supposedly gotten religion on border control after resisting it for quite some time.
Right.
So I don't know. I need to study. I've always liked him as a person.
Sure.
But, you know, I've always liked Orrin Hatch, even though I know he is a target of the Tea Party this time around.
Yeah, and unfortunately, he's moved against the Second Amendment in recent years, too.
Well, a lot of them are moving against a lot of these amendments, and that's why I was proud of Marco Rubio for dropping his support of SOPA yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a good guy. I like Rubio.
He was the one guy in the last election cycle I was most anxious to vote for. I vote in the state of Florida. I voted for Rubio, and I left the presidential ballot blank.
easy to understand. I mean, you know, McCain is not exactly a Reagan conservative any longer. He used to be at one time.
Well, what do you think the impact of Rick Perry backing out is? I said when I heard the news, I felt sorry for him. My co-host here said he didn't feel sorry for any politician, but you know, he stumbled badly in those debates, but I think the thing he could never overcome was his position on that immigration during that first debate, or first or second debate.
Yeah, I think it was a double whammy. I think he could have overcome one or the other, but not both simultaneously, and I think that really hurt him, especially those three or four debates where he stumbled. I think what is allowing Newt to rise is the very thing that caused Perry to fall, which is the debate performance. I think people want to see Newt Gingrich, with all of his flaws, debate Obama because he is an intellectual. He is the best debater on that stage. And I think they just want to see, Newt Gingrich debate Obama and give him a bloody lip.
You know, now one thing in Rick Perry's defense that was not well known when he was stumbling in those debates, he was fresh off of having two vertebrae fused in his back, and he was actually in a great deal of pain during those early debates.
Oh, yeah, and not only that, he was the only person on the stage governing an entire state while running for president at the same time. So he was spread very thin, he was worn out, he was tired. In his defense, I agree. We see what happened when Rick Perry gathered a second win. The last four or five debates, he's been on fire.
Yeah, a little too late. Maybe this will allow him another shot at it.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that is the case because I really like him, and I think he's a good man. This certainly benefits Newt because Newt's within striking distance of Romney now, and I think Perry wisely knows that we have to beat Romney, the conservatives do, and so if he throws his weight behind Newt, which he has done, hopefully then Newt can come out ahead. Now, don't get me wrong, I like Santorum a little bit better than Newt for several different reasons, but I'd still take Newt over Romney. But my biggest concern with Newt is that he has more baggage than Santa Claus on Christmas Eve.
Chris, how is Santorum polling right now in South Carolina?
I think he's in third, I believe. Because Ron Paul's in fourth, and Perry was in fifth, so that would put Santorum in third. The race is going to tighten a bit now that Perry's getting out.
How about, I don't know if did you see DeMint last night? He was on with a judge again, and he's walking right up to supporting Ron Paul, and what I found, if you parsed what he said last night about Ron Paul, he didn't say he disagreed with Ron Paul's position on defense. What he said was that Ron Paul had yet to articulate it accurately enough for people to understand where he was coming from.
And then there's some truth to that. Remember I said before several reasons I believe Ron Paul will not get the nomination. One is his age. He's 76 years old. He'd be the oldest Republican candidate ever. But the other reason is he can be a little quirky. I mean, he's idealistic. I can agree with him 80, 85% of the time, but he's kind of quirky. He doesn't deliver his message well enough. His son does. His son's better at delivering the message. And I think that's what Jim DeMint must be getting at, is that he doesn't always articulate his points well enough.
The quirky is probably a good description. That's one I've heard my wife use before. They describe him as being quirky. I've heard him described as being somewhat herky-jerky. And I would say those are valid criticisms, although I agree with him on most policy issues. In fact, of all the ones that are left, I most identify with Ron Paul's positions.
Yeah, and again, I respect him and I appreciate him from an idealistic perspective. As I said, I think the first time we spoke, the thing is sometimes idealism and pragmatism collide, and you've got to make a choice on what is better for advancing your cause. You can't get everything you want. I wish we could. Sometimes it does come down to what Thomas Paine said, government at its best is the lesser of two evils. I don't like that, but sometimes that is the case, and better to go with half of what you want than none. You know, half a loaf of bread is better than no loaf of bread.
Well, talking about not getting what you want, Obama rejected the Keystone Pipeline yesterday. I think a lot of people expected him to do this, but at a time where we need jobs, a time when energy costs are soaring, Obama's catering, it seems like, to his special interest groups, trying to fire up the liberal base and once again favors politics over job creation.
Oh, yeah, and there may even be a deeper end game behind this when you really get right down to it. Might be more than just sticking it to the oil industry and favoring the environmentalist extreme organizations. China has a shot of getting that oil. And it's obvious that Obama likes China. I mean, he's been there. He's praised them there in China. So it very well could be he's stiffing the U.S. to let China have that oil.
Chris, now, as this thing plays out, when we get to Virginia, there's only going to be two guys on that ballot.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see the dynamics going forward?
I think the protest votes will favor Ron Paul. Even people who probably wouldn't vote for him would probably vote, you know, the hardcore conservatives would probably vote for Ron Paul. The rest will say, okay, Romney's our candidate, I don't like it, but I'll plug my nose and vote for him. So I think it all depends on just how deeply conservative you really are, who you're going to vote for.
Well, a lot of people are arguing that Ron Paul is the only true conservative in the bunch.
I wouldn't call him a conservative. I'd call him a classical liberal, which is a libertarian by today's standards. He's probably a better way to sum it up. He's a Jeffersonian conservative. I'd call him that.
Wow. Jefferson was one of my favorites.
I like Jefferson, although I'm more of a Washington Federalist, if that makes sense.
No, I understand what you mean.
A little more on the states' rights, a little bit more on the federalism, but I greatly respect Jefferson. But isn't it interesting, Thomas Jefferson, as president, governed more as a Federalist than as a Libertarian?
You know what's funny is I'm having this conversation with an American. I usually have to have this conversation with the immigrants because they seem to be about the only ones left that know U.S. history.
Well, I am the son of Italian immigrants, so maybe that has something to do with it.
Well, you got that around the dinner table. Well, Chris, listen, we ran over on that segment before you, so we're out of time for this one.
Sure, no problem.
It's a pleasure speaking to you. Jason, tell them one more time about Chris and his website.
Chris is the president of Red Momentum Strategies.
Chris,
absolutely.
Good talking to you. We'll look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Jason and I will be back on the other side of this break. We're going to talk a little bit more about the history of money. The Dow is up 30. The S&P is up 6. The dollar is down yet again. We'll see you shortly.
There needs to be a focus on an immediate increase in spending.
You're telling me we got to go spend money to keep from going bankrupt? The answer is yes, I'm telling you.
Spend money to keep from going bankrupt. I would say that sums up Keynesian economics in a nutshell. Jason, it was on this day in 1861 that Georgia, good old state of Georgia, seceded from the Union. It was on this day in 1883 that Thomas Edison, his first village using his electric lighting system, was put into operation. That was up in New Jersey. And it was on this day in 1937 that Howard Robard Hughes set a transcontinental air record. He flew from Los Angeles to New York City in 7 hours and 28 minutes. You know, a lot of people, particularly depending on their age, do not realize what an interesting character old Howard Hughes was. He was more than just the guy with the long fingernails. All right, on the history of money. Now, today we'd like to cover something that most of us generally take for granted. Money is defined as something generally accepted as a medium of exchange, a measure of value, and a means of payment.
Well, it often comes in many forms, metal coins, denominations of paper, that's fiat money. In ancient times, you could see things like the wampum, the American Indians trading wampum. We also saw decorative metallic objects being traded in West Africa, even whale's teeth. So a lot of different things have been used as this medium of exchange. But the central thing to remember is that money is that commodity, which becomes generally accepted as a medium of exchange.
Yeah, now bartering has been around since the beginning of time, where you trade one article to someone else for another. But what happens when they don't have what you want and vice versa? Now, money is what solves this problem. Jason, I think you've done a whole segment on that. But real value with each exchange and everyone gaining from the convenience of using what we now refer to as money. Now, the problem that has always existed with money is who creates it. Governments have taken upon themselves to prevent abuse, but unfortunately, they've taken it upon themselves to be the abusers and the manipulators. Old President James Madison said, quote, "History records that the money changers have used every form of abuse, intrigue, deceit, and violent means possible to maintain their control over governments by controlling money and its issuance." He's referring to central bankers.
Yeah, if you had to read one book, and you don't have to be an economic expert, if you just want a very good, simple explanation about what money is, how it evolved on the market through the market process over years, remember, governments never created money. They usurped the power over money that had arisen on the marketplace and stamped their official headings on it, but they never, no government ever set out to create money, just like no government ever decided we're going to create a language. It evolves through the market process of individuals. But if you have to read one book about the history of money and how it's evolved over the years, how the government's taken control and literally destroyed our money system, the book to read is Murray Rothbard's What Government Has Done to Our Money. Murray Rothbard, What Government Has Done to Our Money, is an exceptional piece that's very accessible. You don't have to be an expert. Provides really good detail on a lot of the themes that we talk about here.
Jason, you know, you can even go back to biblical times when Jesus threw the money changers out of the temple. And Jesus went into the temple and cast out all of them that sold and bought in the temple and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them they sold doves. But the Bible does not explain this in more detail, but I think you'd find that interesting. Apparently he had a problem with the money changers too, so that's about all the time we have today. There's a lot of history on money, but most of it, when it involves the government, turns out to be rather badly. And it's been a bad week so far for the old U.S. dollar. It's been a real surprise. What's also a surprise, Jason, is that we're out of time. So, on behalf of my co-host, Jason Riddle, and our producer, Taylor Austin, my name is Alan Butler. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.
Clinton time! Clinton time!
That's all, folks.